Morning, everyone. Hope you had a nice keynote this morning. So thank you for coming to this session. My name is Brian Keller. I'm a technical evangelist for Microsoft. I have been with Microsoft for about 11 years and have worked in the Visual Studio team for the majority of that time. Today's session, we're going to be looking at a couple of my favorite technologies that are part of the Visual Studio family, and that includes Microsoft Test Manager and Lab Management. I just want to get a quick feel for the room. How many people already use Microsoft Test Manager today? Okay, great. And how many people have used Lab Management? Usually far fewer. Okay, wow, outstanding. So that's great. So I just want to set some basic expectations for the room, just to give you an opportunity to go to another session if you would like to. Of course, I would love for you to stick around, but I do just want to make sure that you understand what this topic is really targeted at. There are a few different audiences that I have in mind when I put together this type of session. The first is if any of you are manual testers, meaning that you wake up every day and you run through a set of tests to try to simulate what the user is doing, try to find bugs in a manual fashion, then I'll have a lot of content in here for you that will explain what Microsoft Test Manager is. It was really built for you, and I'll try to give you some of my best practices and tips along the way for those of you who are already using Microsoft Test Manager. Another audience is if you are a developer and you want to start working with functional UI tests. We have a nice workflow for going from manual tests from people that might be using Microsoft Test Manager directly over into coded UI tests. I'm not going to go deep into coded UI tests in this session. There are several recordings I've done in the past where I do go deeper into coded UI tests, but I will just give you a flavor for what you can do. The other thing that this session is targeted at is teams. So if you are a representative from a team and you're looking for ways to improve software quality by producing better bugs, then that's a key theme for what I'll be talking about. And also, there's this movement towards agile testing. I talked in my foundation session on Tuesday about this move towards continuous delivery, where if you look at how rapidly we're shipping to production today as opposed to even a year or two ago, I would imagine most of us in this room are pushing to production much faster than you used to. And along with that, we need to come up with techniques and tools and processes that can help us bake quality into everything we do as opposed to necessarily having a month at the end of it of each release where we just fix bugs. When you're pushing to production every month, you have to be fixing bugs and finding them all of the time. And so that's a big theme for what I'll be looking at. And finally, if you're looking for ways to automatically provision dev and test environments or build, deploy, test workflows, then the end of my session I'll be talking about lab management. So there's a few topics that I'm not covering. This is not a session that's focused on unit testing or mocking or fakes. It's also not based on web and load testing. If you are interested in web and load testing, my colleague Anu is doing a great session next door where you can learn more about that. So I just want to set those expectations just to make sure that everybody knows what we're getting into. Hopefully there will be something for everyone. So I also package up all of my content as virtual machines, so everything that you see me do today, you can go to this URL up here, you can download a set of virtual machines that contains Team Foundation Server, Visual Studio, Microsoft Test Manager. It also has lots of sample data, users, and the reason I do this is just to make it really easy for you to go back home and put your hands on the product and see how it can be used in a real world environment. I also ship hands-on labs that you can go through that cover not only Microsoft Test Manager, but also a variety of other topics, getting started with Team Foundation Server, that sort of thing. So these are all free virtual machines. I see some people taking screenshots, so I'll give you just a second to get the URL down. And my slides will be available at the end on Channel 9 for folks that don't get a chance to write down everything. And I've written a couple of books, co-authored a couple of books, I should say. These are available in the bookstore. The one on the left has an entire section on what we're covering today, software testing. The one on the right is really focused on what you should be thinking about as a Team Foundation server administrator. So I'm not trying to push my books on you, but a lot of people ask for more resources, so I wanted to make you aware of those. So let's talk about software testing. I like to start by looking at a few examples just to remind ourselves why quality matters. This is what the US Navy called a smart ship back in the early 90s. This was one of the first ships of its kind where they were going back and updating the older fleets by putting modern day computers on board. Sounds like a great idea, right? Unfortunately, they didn't quite test for everything because when they went out at sea and a crew member entered a zero in one of the text boxes, it caused a divide by zero and shut down the entire system for 3 hours. So luckily this was at peacetime, but you can imagine you really don't want to be the seaman who entered this number and have to explain why the whole ship is dead in the water. You especially don't want to be the person that was responsible for testing this. Here's another one I like to pick on Europe when I'm in town, and this is the Ariane 5. You might be familiar. They actually reused a lot of code from the Ariane 4. Usually, when something goes well, it's a good idea to reuse code. Unfortunately, in this case, the Ariane 5 took a different flight path, and they didn't take that into account for the code that they reused. So unfortunately, that caused a divide overflow, and this was about a $500 million mistake. Luckily nobody was hurt. If you like these types of examples, there's a presentation from OSCON a few years ago called An Illustrated History of Failure, and the presenter goes through and he attempts to quantify the value of a human life. So he takes the average number of working years that you have, takes the population, divides that into the GDP, and every one of us on average is worth something around 2 million euros. But he makes the argument that for the first time in history, due to the magic of software, with one line of code, you can actually erase all of the value that you bring to this world and those of hundreds of your peers. So software quality is important, and part of my job is to make sure that none of us show up in a future Illustrated History of Failure example. Finally, if anyone's been to Stockholm, this is my favorite example to talk about. This is my favorite museum in the world right now. It's called the Vasa Museum. This is a boat that was built, I believe it was the 1700s, and it was really meant to be kind of the flagship of the Swedish Navy. The problem was that the king came along and said that he really wanted to add an extra row of cannons to the top deck up here. Unfortunately, they didn't take into account that they would need additional ballast down below. So they did not revisit the spec and understand the impact that this change would have. And as a result, it actually sank less than 1 nautical mile outside of port. So not revisiting the requirements was the first mistake, but it turns out that, guess what, QA actually knew about this problem. They had a team of sailors stand on the top of the deck and run back and forth three times. And the person running the test said, "We need to stop this test. If we keep doing this, we're going to sink this ship." And guess what? QA was ignored. So, you know, we think we have these new problems in this day and age of computers, but really these problems have been around for a long time. The good news is that Sweden got a museum out of it, so if you're ever in town, I highly recommend it. Of course, I work at Microsoft, so we should look at some of our mistakes. We're the world's largest software developer last time I checked. This is a product I worked on. Not sure how you would go about closing that exactly. Here's another one. This file is still copying. An error has occurred while displaying the error that has occurred while creating an error report. I mean, it's okay, except it's missing a period at the end, right? And this is my favorite. Okay. All right. So what do we do about this? It's obvious that everyone has a stake in software quality. No matter what types of systems you work on, whether you're a 90,000 person development company like Microsoft or a one person development shop. So what do we do about this? We really wanted to answer this question a few years ago. And so I'm going to take you quickly through the evolution of why we got into this product called Microsoft Test Manager and Lab Management. The first thing we did is we looked at the software lifecycle. And I like to tell this story by talking about one of my favorite activities, which is mountain climbing. When I live in Seattle, I do live in Seattle, and when I'm in Seattle and it's rainy for about 14 months out of the year, I spend a lot of the time actually in the gym training. The cost of failure if something goes wrong in the gym is quite low. Maybe I hurt my finger, I'm out of the gym for a week, no big deal, right? But by the time I actually get out onto an actual climb, the cost of failure can be quite high at that point. Here I am on my first glacier climb. You can see several hundred meters in either direction would lead to certain death. And right behind us, this is a hailstorm that was getting ready to hit us about 20 minutes after this photo was taken. And when you're in that situation, you want to be really sure that you've tested yourself and your gear and your team and your escape plan and so on. Software is the same way, right? And so for years, Visual Studio has been and will continue to give developers the tools that they need to help catch those bugs. Hopefully, as soon as you introduce a line of code change, you have unit tests that run in the background and that kind of thing. But that's not going to catch everything. And so we really wanted to make sure that we could give testers a great set of tools to help them be productive as well. So we said, well, what does that mean to give testers a great set of tools? And we looked at the landscape of testers on the market. And at the far left end of the spectrum, you have people that wake up every day and run manual tests, and they simulate what a user might be doing. And at the right end of the spectrum, you have people that are writing code that tests other code. Maybe those are unit tests or web tests and so on. And what we found is that about 70% of the testing is actually on the left end of the spectrum. And you might think, well, how could that be? We're software developers. We write code to automate things for a reason. But if you look at manual testing serves a very important purpose. Number one, you know, you don't always want to invest in automated tests right away, because chances are you are going to want to rapidly evolve the application, and you're going to find yourself spending more time fixing broken tests than actually finding bugs that those tests discover. The other thing that's great about manual testing is that a human is hopefully always going to be smarter than a computer, and so a human can look at a computer and say, hey, this is broken. Even though I know that this test case is passing, I also see that this logo is upside down and backwards or something like that. So we think that manual testing is always going to be around, and probably in the majority. But the problem is that most of the testing tools out there actually target the right end of the spectrum. How many different unit testing frameworks do we need? I mean, there's just a lot of different test automation tools out there. And so Microsoft really felt like we can serve the need here by coming out with a first class set of tools for manual testers. Finally, this is a problem I think all of us can relate to, which is what happens when a bug is found by a tester? They take it to the developer, and the developer looks at them sideways and says, you know, works on my machine. That happens all the time, right? I'm sure we've probably all even been on both sides of that equation. I know I have. The reality is that the tester probably did find a bug, and it probably does work on the developer's machine. But there's oftentimes something different about the way that the test is being run by the tester than the developer. Maybe it's a different machine configuration, a different set of sample data. Maybe the interpretation of the test case by the tester is different than when the developer read and implemented the requirement. And that's all fine and good, and we can have that conversation to resolve that, but we don't always have time for that conversation. And what that means is, you have bugs that go unfixed, and you know that your customers are going to find them. And so we really wanted to help improve that. So during the rest of the presentation, I'm going to be showing you how we've evolved our product strategy to address these types of needs, which is, let's give testing a first-class location within Visual Studio. Let's make sure that the manual testers have a great set of tools. And finally, let's make sure that developers have everything that they need when a bug comes in to quickly understand what was happening on the testing side. Okay? And of course, all of this is built on Team Foundation Server. I'm assuming everyone's at least roughly familiar with Team Foundation Server, but if not, I just wanted to make sure that you knew that we do use Team Foundation Server on the back end for everything we're doing. Now, if you're not using Team Foundation Server and you want to start using these tools, you can get started by doing everything I'm going to do today with Team Foundation Service, which is our cloud-hosted version of Team Foundation Server. You can just go to tfs.visualstudio.com, and in a matter of seconds, you can sign up for an account on the service. So I just want to mention that in case people are working in an organization that maybe doesn't have TFS in place. So without further ado, I'll switch over. And this is the virtual machine that I mentioned earlier. I'm going to start by launching Microsoft Test Manager. And for those that haven't seen it before, I'm just going to spend a few minutes getting you familiar with the tool. The first thing you'll see on the left-hand side is that we have a list of requirements that we've pulled in straight from Team Foundation Server. So this is just the list of things that we are going to be testing. Now, you can structure this differently if you want to. You can have just a loose set of test cases, but I generally encourage that as much as possible, you link the test cases that you're writing back to those requirements, because that's going to give you the nice reporting later on that allows you to say, what's the quality of this requirement? Oh, I see, it has 5 test cases and only 3 of them passed in last night's build. So that's why we do that. And so if you look at this particular requirement as an example, on the right-hand side, we have a list of 2 test cases that we've written. And test cases basically are written to provide various paths through the application or through the experience. And so here you can see that I've written a test case. For those of you that already use TFS, this is just a work item within TFS. Down here, you see a list of test steps. And the test steps basically just tell the tester what they need to be doing when they test this application. So it's mostly just a set of English or, you know, whatever language you want, text. The one unique thing here is that when I use this Twitter-style syntax, we actually create a set of data-bound columns down here. And so instead of writing this test case once for Spanish addresses and once for English addresses, I could write it once and then use different data values to actually data drive that test. And so what that means is when I come back over to my test tab, the test tab is what shows the tester on a daily basis what they need to be running. So here I can see that I have a few test cases. The last time I ran this set of test cases, they failed. These passed. You can say that some tests are blocked if you need to. Like if you knew that a test was going to fail because you needed to have another prerequisite test, like setting up a user account, then you could just block it in here. And that tells the rest of the team, don't waste your time on that particular test case. You may notice that that this test case is actually listed twice. In fact, both of these are listed twice. The reason for that is that we've defined multiple test configurations. And so oftentimes you want to run your test cases once on IE and once on Chrome, or once on Windows Server and once on Windows Client. And that's just the way that you can represent the same test case against multiple configurations. So we'll take one of these test cases and I'll just run it. And this is going to switch over to what's called Microsoft Test Runner. Test Runner is responsible for a few functions, the first of which is just telling the tester the list of steps that they need to run. So it's not unlike what a lot of test teams do, which is they have a list of Excel test steps or test steps in Microsoft Word. But what's really unique about Test Runner is that when I click Start, it's capturing rich data in the background about everything that I'm doing. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, we talked about this problem of a tester going to a developer and finding this bug and the developer saying, well, gosh, it works on my machine. What's different about what you did? And Microsoft Test Manager will actually inspect the system that you're running on, and it will try to capture rich diagnostics about everything that's happening on that machine or any other machine within your test environment. And I'll show you the list of diagnostics that we can capture in a few minutes, but it includes things like video recordings, IntelliTrace files, event logs, and that sort of thing. So when I click Start, it's going to start collecting all that information. The other nice thing about Test Runner is that it can make a tester's life easier by starting to allow them to fast forward through these manual test cases. So this is not yet full automation. It doesn't replace the tester, but if I already ran this test case once, it makes it easy for me to select that set of test steps and click on play, and it's going to go back and play back that set of test steps. It looks like it's just warming up my application here. And there we go. So this works really well with web applications. It works with most of the Microsoft application stacks like Windows Forms and WPF. And then there's other types of frameworks like Silverlight that you can compile using a set of DLLs. There's a help topic in the MSDN library that goes into more detail on the exact applications that are supported for this type of test automation. But again, my advice is just to try it with your application type. You might find that you can fast forward through most of the steps, and then occasionally you might have a custom control from a third-party vendor that the tester might have to manually work through themselves. But anyway, I fast-forwarded through the first few steps. The test case is telling me to verify that this value is set equal to 1, which it is. I'll pass that. And now, just for fun, I'll just hit play and finish off that particular test case. At this point, if I wanted to, in that iteration, I could move to the next iteration. And what this does is it actually queues up the next row of values in that test parameters column. So now you see that it's giving me a different value to enter into the quantity box. Okay? Pretty straightforward, nothing fancy about anything we've done so far. But these are the types of experiences that we want to use to make a tester's life easier, and so that when they do find a bug, we can give you some rich data. Let's talk about the rich data options that are available. I just went into plan and properties. And this is always a place where I encourage developers and testers to come together to start to define what sets of information might be useful anytime a tester finds a bug for the types of applications that they're testing. And so here you can see that I have this test settings down here. If I open that up, you'll see the list of default test settings that you can capture. A couple of these are self-explanatory. The action log just says every time you click on a control, if we can tell what that control is, we're going to capture that in a file somewhere. And what I mean by that is that if you click on a text box, we're going to grab the name of that text box control, and we're going to put that in a log somewhere. Code coverage, so this allows you to go back later on and compare this against the list of methods with which are within your .NET application to see how your test plan is actually exercising your code base. System information, that's one that I recommend always turning on. It's just going to capture basic things like operating system, service pack level, RAM, hard drive space, that kind of thing. Video recording is, as the name implies, it's going to capture video recordings of everything the tester is doing. And you can see why that might be useful if a test fails. But I always like to point out that you can also turn this on even if a test case passes. Now, why might you do that? A couple of reasons. Several of my customers like using this for creating ad hoc documentation. So if you're a product owner and you want to see the way that a feature works in last night's build, one way to do that is to go install the build and spin up a machine and go try that feature. But if you have a set of testers who are already testing those features and you're capturing video recording, you can just connect to that test run and open up that video recording and get an idea for how that particular feature is working. That's number one. Number two is if you are outsourcing your testing efforts, this is a really nice way to ensure that you're getting what you pay for. So you can turn this on and you can periodically go back and check to make sure that the testers who are running your test cases are running the test cases the way that you've instructed them to do so. Now, as you can imagine, for those of you that might be TFS administrators, the amount of data that some of these collectors start to take up can be quite consuming within Team Foundation Server. Video recordings is one. There's about a meg per minute of data that gets captured within there. The biggest culprit is probably IntelliTrace events. Those can be multiple gigs easily. And so I have two strategies to recommend for dealing with that. Number one, we've published what's called the Test Attachments Power Tool, Test Attachments Cleaner Power Tool. It ships as part of the Team Foundation Server Power Tools. What that power tool allows you to do is run against your TFS server and say, allow me to clean up all of the, IntelliTrace files and video recordings from last iteration. And it will go clean up your TFS server. The other thing that I recommend is you can actually have multiple test settings that the testers use when they run their test runs. And so in this example, I actually have a lightweight diagnostics test setting, So if I come down to here, you'll see that I have this lightweight diagnostics and full diagnostics. And what that allows me to do when I'm a tester is run with options and specify a different test setting when I run this. And so you might decide that 90% of the time you want to run with the lightweight test settings enabled, but then if a developer says, you know, I really don't have enough data to understand what's going on, they might ask the tester to rerun the test case and capture an IntelliTrace file or something that's a more detailed set of information. And so that's one way that you can do that. And when they do that, they can go back and assign, attach those additional files to the same bug when they're filing a bug. One more thing that I'll show you in the test settings is the event log. Event log allows you to scope based on the types of events, as you might expect. And you can specify different test settings configurations for different machines within your test environment. In my demo, I only have a single machine up here. But in a real world example, you'll probably have a web browser that the tester is using, maybe a back-end web server. Another machine might be a database server. And you might decide on the web client, let's get a video recording. On the SQL server, let's get an event log in case we have any security audits to look at. On the web server, let's get an IntelliTrace file. And you can even define your own custom collectors as well. So in the MSDN library, there's a help topic that says how to write your own custom collectors. So maybe your application tends to spit log data out to some file somewhere. Instead of relying on the tester to manually grab that file every time they file a bug, just have the test collector automatically go fetch that file anytime they find a bug. Those are the types of things that are going to make it much easier for developers when you get those bugs and you're trying to figure out what in the heck is going on over there. Now, that's one way that we can make testers more productive by giving them a great set of tools. And hopefully, as developers, you're seeing ways that you might benefit from this as well. There's another problem that we wanted to solve with Microsoft Test Manager. And this is especially prevalent in agile teams that are practicing continuous integration and continuous delivery. The problem comes about that if you're building multiple times per day, or even once every day, as a test team, you may not always want to pick up every single build to test with. And so oftentimes testers get in the habit of going to talk to the developers and say, hey, is that requirement that I was waiting for ready? Is that bug that I filed fixed so that I can make sure that it no longer reproduces? And you know, that's fine if the testers and the developers want to talk to each other, but we felt like we could make this easier by just using the information that's already available within Team Foundation Server. So if I go to the Track tab and I choose Assign Build, you'll see that at the top here, I have a current build that's in use, this 318.3, and I also see that there's a new build available, 318.4. And then down in the list below, we show you a list of all of the work items that have changed since the last build. For those of you that don't use Team Foundation Server yet, a work item can be a requirement, it can be a user story, a task. It's just something that the team is tracking as a unit of work. And so in this case, as a tester, I'm looking at this and saying, okay, someone wrote a regular expression. That's great, but that doesn't necessarily have any bearing on my test plan. So this build is probably not worth my time. If I look at the next build that came out, this 318.5, now all of a sudden this gets to be a little bit more interesting. So now I see that there's a user story that's resolved, and maybe I have a new set of tests that I'm ready to run against that user story. So this build looks like it's interesting, but then I wait a few minutes later, there's a new build. And so you can see that this just keeps growing on itself. And so now we also have this bug that's been fixed, or the developer saying it's fixed, but on my team I always want to make sure that the tester verifies that it's fixed. So I'm going to pick up this build, and this is going to give me a set of new things that I can go test. But there's another part of this question, which is, all right, you know, I have a set of new things I can test, but over the last week I maybe ran 300 test cases. And let's say that 250 of them passed and I filed a bunch of bugs, but I'm picking up a new build. So how do I figure out which test cases I need to go rerun as a result of some code that maybe has changed and is breaking some existing functionality? That's where we introduced a capability called test impact analysis to help you answer that question. Test impact analysis is available for your .NET code, and what it does is it runs in the background while you're running your test cases. And so when I run test case number 41, it says we invoked these three DLLs, and on this DLL, we had to call these five methods. And then a developer goes back and changes one of these methods, and they check it in, and then you pick up that build. We'll tell the test team you might want to go back and rerun test case 41 because it depends on some code that was changed. It doesn't mean 41 is going to fail. It also, this is important, does not mean that the rest of the test cases which are not impacted are always going to work moving forward, because there could be other changes that we don't detect, changes to environment data, changes to native code. But it does tell you as a tester, if you have, you know, 30 minutes before your lunch break and you just picked up this new build, what are the test cases that we think you should rerun that are going to give you the highest probability of letting the development team know that they just broke something? And so when I pick up this build, it's going to say there's some new tests that you might want to run as a result of test impact analysis data. You can view those recommended tests, and then you can reset them back to active. And when I move back to the test tab, this now tells the test team that these tests are active. It also tells the test team up here that there's a new build that they should be using as well. Okay? So everything that I've shown you at so far is an approach that has been in the industry for a long time called formal testing, or formal test case management. And the idea with formal test case management is you start with a requirement, or whatever you want to call it, maybe it's a user story or a feature. You start with that list of requirements, and then you write a set of test cases, and you run those test cases until you ship the software. There's also another type of testing which is becoming more and more popular, which is called exploratory testing, or agile testing. And when you look at people that practice agile testing, they say, look, let me just get in and try to break the application. I'm an experienced tester. I know what I'm doing. Don't force me to write all these formal test cases. That's great, and oftentimes agile testing ends up finding a lot of bugs. But there are a couple of criticisms with agile testing as well. The first criticism that we hear is that when you're agile testing, you might find really bad bugs, because maybe you're just in kind of, pardon the expression, but hacking around the application. You're sitting there for 45 minutes trying to do a bunch of different things that generate a bug. All of a sudden you find a bug and you can't remember the 10 steps that you did over the last 30 minutes that led to that bug. That's one criticism. Another criticism is that if you find a bug, great, you file that to the development team, they fix it, great, but then in 2 weeks, that bug regresses. How do you know that that bug has regressed unless you happen to go down the same random, if you will, path of doing exploratory testing for that same feature? And so we've tried to address those criticisms with our approach to helping you embrace agile testing. And so this is a capability that we introduced in Microsoft Test Manager 2012. So if you're still on 2010, make sure that you upgrade to take advantage of this. And when I say do exploratory testing, it's going to allow me to just start exploring my application. And you'll notice that Test Runner looks a little bit different. It still can capture all the rich data for you in the background, but it's not going to give me a list of test steps. Instead, we're going to rely on the individual tester to come in here and use what they know about testing applications to try to find bugs. Now, there's a lot of different techniques for the ways in which you can approach exploratory testing. One of my colleagues, James Whitaker, has written several books on this. I'm not going to try to go into all of the details on that, but one of the approaches that he advocates is to think about exploratory testing the same way you might think about taking a vacation. If all of us went to Rome and we had 1 day to spend in Rome, we would probably go to the Colosseum and the Forum, and we'd all kind of do the same thing. But if we decided that we were going to spend a few days in Rome, and each one of us was to go into a different area, one of us might say, you know what, I'm really into drinking wine. I'm going to go try to find some wineries. Somebody else might say, I really like looking at old churches, and we might go find old churches. And so you can look at exploratory testing in a very similar way. You can say that one person is going to play the persona of a hacker, and you're going to get into the application and try to break things. Another person is going to play the persona of, I'll pick on my mom. My mom is terrified of shopping on the internet and providing her credit card. But if you're going to try to build a website that sells items to my mom, you might try to make sure that every page has a 1-800 number that you can call, or an email address, or some way that she can connect back to the main company. It wouldn't make sense for you to put a test case that says, make sure this page has a phone number, make sure that page has a phone number. But instead, that's a good example of where exploratory testing says, just go look at the application like a human being would and try to find out if it makes sense for that type of user. So again, go buy James's books. He's got a couple of great books on this topic if that's interesting. But I'll just show you how you can do exploratory testing in the context of Microsoft Test Manager. I click Start Testing, which means that it's now in the background capturing all of the data and the rich actions that I'm performing. And remember, all this data could be coming off of multiple machines within my environment. And what I'm going to do is just click around the application a few times. I'm just trying to simulate what a tester might be doing if they're in an application for, say, 45 minutes, clicking around, trying to find a bug. And all of a sudden, they say, all right, you know, let's click on delete. Let's see what happens there. We'll scroll down and look at the page, and you'll notice that customer actually says none, created by none. So those values were on the previous page, so this looks like it's a bug. What I can do is go ahead and capture a screenshot just to make sure the developer knows what I'm talking about. We'll say create bug. Delete page is missing values. And then down here, you'll see that during that testing session, we actually captured little screenshots of everything that was happening during my test run. Now, remember, this could be a 45-minute testing session, so we probably don't want to overwhelm the developer with a long list of actions. So what we can do is click on Change Steps, and I actually think that the last few actions are the most relevant. So when we entered the dashboard, those are kind of the most relevant actions for me. And you'll notice here that when you mouse over, you can kind of see the whole screen. So that's kind of a nice way that you can understand the broader context. And when I scope those actions, now that's the only information that's going to be filed in the bug. If the developer still needs to go back and access the entire set of actions, they can do so. But generally speaking, we try to make it easy for the tester to hand that data off. So that's great. We'll file the bug. But I also mentioned another problem with exploratory testing, which is how do we make sure that in 2 weeks we still test this functionality to verify that it hasn't been broken again? And to do that, we can take this same set of actions and we can turn it into a test case, a formal test case. And this can become a formal test case that we can run in parallel with our agile testing efforts. And this kind of is designed to give you the best of both worlds. So at this point, I'll say make sure delete page contains correct values. And for those of you that use the older version of Test Manager, a lot of people asked us for rich text support. So I know it's exciting. You know, make sure you don't click confirm. I'm sorry?
Is that going to work when you export to Excel?
Will that work when you export the test case to Excel? I don't think the rich text would work in that case. It would just give you a bunch of HTML. But it should work if you exported this to Word using the test scribe tool. It should include the rich text in that one. Good question. So at that point, I'll go ahead and save that test. I'm back into the exploratory testing tool, so I could keep spending the rest of my afternoon finding bugs. Once I'm done, I can click on End Testing. And this gives you a report of everything that happened during that exploratory testing session. For those of you that are trying to understand the effectiveness of agile testing on your team, these reports are a good way for you to answer the question of whether or not exploratory testing is working for you. Because you can go back and say, hey, when we spent that Friday afternoon doing exploratory testing, did we actually find any bugs? And you can run a report that says that you did find, you know, 10 bugs and created 5 new test cases. Or maybe you find out everyone's just updating their Facebook profile. I don't know. But at least we give you those tools to help answer those questions. And so now if I go back just to show you that this new test case showed up right within my test plan. So that's ready for me to test in a formal fashion moving forward. So next, I'm going to show you how to take this test and turn it into a coded UI test. But we're doing OK on time. So before I do, let me just pause and see if there's any questions so far. Yeah. Is the recording that I'm using going to work on a WPF application? And yes, it will. The only caveat there is that if you have third-party controls from control vendors, DevExpress, Infragistics, and so on, you should check with them to see if they have done the work to support the test automation requirements that we have. Most of those control vendors we've worked with, they do have support for a lot of them. And the idea is that you just take an extra DLL from them, you compile that as part of your application, and that gives us the accessibility data that we need. So yes, most of the time WPF works just fine. Yeah?
Does Test Manager only comes with Visual Studio Ultimate?
Good question. Does Test Manager only come with Visual Studio Ultimate? There's actually 3 ways to get Test Manager. There's Test Professional, there's Visual Studio Premium, and Visual Studio Ultimate. Test Professional is the least expensive. That's really designed for people that are doing testing, you know, kind of all day. Visual Studio Premium now includes Test Professional. So if you are somebody who's a developer by day and a tester by night, that's a good SKU for you to look at. And then Visual Studio Ultimate layers on more capabilities. Like if you're getting IntelliTrace files out of your test runs, Visual Studio Ultimate's the only way to debug those. So that's a really nice SKU to have, at least for a couple of people on your team. Yeah. Good question. Is there going to be a Microsoft Test Manager 2013? Yes, there is. I just haven't had time to update all my virtual machines yet, so that's the only reason I'm showing 2012. 2013 is mostly the same to what you're seeing up here. We've done a lot of work on the web access layer for Team Foundation Server 2013. So one of the things I'm not showing today is that you could actually go to a web interface now. You could run your test cases. You could manage your test cases. You still need to be licensed with those SKUs that I mentioned to use those capabilities. But that's really designed if you, let's say you do half your testing on Windows and half your testing on a Mac. You can at least go to that Mac and you can run through those test cases and report the results. You won't get all the test automation and the rich data capture that you get on those third-party operating systems, but we at least try to make it available for you to run through your tests and file bugs if you need to. The question is, can you reorder the order in which test cases can be run? It should be. I don't know if we've specifically implemented ordering in the web access yet. I'd have to check. But the idea is that all of that test case management functionality from the plan tab and the test tab should be available over in the web interface as well. Yeah. Good question. Does Microsoft Test Manager work on Windows XP? I know that Microsoft Test Manager 2012 and 2013 do not, but you should be able to use Microsoft Test Manager 2010 on Windows XP. So if you have kind of a mixed environment, some people are running XP, some are running, you know, newer operating systems, you can install both versions. When you buy the newest version, we always give you downgrade rights to install the older versions as well. Yeah, good question. Yeah. How do you plan the sequence of which tests to run and when to test them? That's a great question. It varies based on the type of what's called a test suite that you create. So when I come into my test suite over here, There's a few different types of test suites. One is a requirements-based test suite, and that's what you're looking at here, which is to simply say, pull in all of the test cases that are linked to this particular requirement. In this view, you actually don't have the option of ordering this list. If you do need an ordered list, you can create an empty test suite container. You can manually add test cases to that, and then you can specify the order that those should be run. Yeah, good question. Yeah.
Yesterday morning, I saw in one of the ALM sessions that you now can create hierarchical backlogs of features and stories and whatever.
You can.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you can see here as well?
That's a great question. Yeah, that's a great question. So just to repeat, he said that we're introducing Agile Portfolio Management with Team Foundation Server 2013. And what that means is you can now have, for example, features, and then underneath that you can have user stories, and that's a way of being able to have multiple teams contributing user stories that might accrue to broader features across your organization. He's asking if you can see that within this particular view. No, as of today, you can't. I think that's a great idea. It's something for us to think about. Right now, you could pull in all of the features and all of the user stories and link test cases to those individually, but there's no way of representing that hierarchy in this view. Yeah, it's a good question. We'll do one more, and then I'll keep moving along just so we get through everything.
What about offline testing? If I'm not connected to the
device, I always get that question. Yeah, so what about offline testing? Yeah, there's no offline testing story. So that is something we commonly get asked questions about. It's something that we've considered in the future. But you will, in everything that I'm showing you, you will need to have connection to a Team Foundation server. Now, what a lot of customers do to work around this requirement is if they have a dedicated test lab, they might set up a TFS server just for that lab. Team Foundation server comes with every MSDN subscription now. So chances are, if you have MSDN subscriptions on your team, you probably own lots of licenses to Team Foundation Server. So that's one thing that you can do. I know that may not work for everybody. From a customer side, yeah, I understand. Yeah. So I'm going to keep moving. I think we'll probably have questions at the end. If not, I'll stick around. But I did want to show you the way that you can create an automated test case. So this is just Visual Studio 2012 again, but you could use 2010 and do the same thing that I'm doing. I'm just going to create a coded UI test project, and a coded UI test allows you to fully automate a test from the user's point of view. And so earlier I showed you how you can fast forward a manual test while it's maybe the application is still evolving and while you still have a human being involved, but eventually, you might decide, okay, this test case is passing on a regular basis. It's no longer something we can test with every day. We only have limited manual testing resources. But this is a piece of functionality which is important, so we'll write a coded UI test to fully automate that as part of our build workflow. There's two ways to create those coded UI tests. One is to just use a recorder to open up your application and start clicking through it, capturing actions, adding assertions. The other way is to take that action recording that the manual testers already created and to use that to start building your coded UI test. I'll use both approaches. I'll start with the action recording, and then we'll customize it using the recorder. If I just happen to know that particular test case is test case number 41, and just to remind you, that's this one that we're looking at here. So you'll see a set of actions. And what we just did is we converted that test case into, let me zoom in. We converted that into a series of methods which correspond to those test steps. Now, there is a trick to getting this to work right, and that is when your testers are running the test case and capturing an action recording, you need to tell them that they should be clicking on each test step as they go and passing that test step. What I mean by that is when it says open this web application, they do that action, they click on that step one passed. Click on this button, they do that, and they click on step two passed. That's the only way that we get the correlation between the actions the tester is doing and the code that we need to generate. And that's obviously going to give you much easier code to maintain moving forward. So for example, when I go to definition on this guy, you'll notice that this all it does is open the web application. And that way, if we need to easily change that later on and override the URL, it's easy to do that. The other thing you'll notice that I got automatically when I did this is that we data bound this to the data source, which represents the set of test parameter data. And just to remind you what I'm talking about there, what that means is this new quantity field is actually data bound, so that this is nice later on if a tester needs to go back and add an extra row of data to the test data that you're running. It makes it easy for them to do that without having to know how to actually write the test case using code. So it's something that any manual tester can do. And here you can see that we're using that new quantity column as part of the test step which requires it. Now, there's one thing I still need to do to make this a good coded UI test. If I ran this test, the only thing it would do is click through the application and then tell me when it was done. It's not actually replacing the tester who needs to look at the application and say, does this look right? In order to do that, I need to add an additional step, which is some validation logic. And so I'll just place my cursor at the same point where I asked the tester to verify that application. And we'll say generate code using the coded UI test builder. You'll notice the builder down here in the lower right-hand corner. I'll just open up my application and put it at the point where we need to validate this. And so this is a really simple one. We're just going to validate that that particular control is equal to 1. And notice when I drag and drop, there's a huge range of controls. I can even validate the start button if I really want to. But we're just looking at the document object model for the browser right now, and we're inspecting that. And we're going to return a set of name value pairs for all of the properties that IE already knows about this particular layout. I could add multiple assertions if I wanted to. I'm just going to add a single one right now. There's another best practice I recommend, which is you see this message box. If this assertion fails and you don't put anything in this text box, then the failure is going to say something like, you know, control text box 1 is not equal to 1. And that can become really frustrating when you're a tester the next morning saying, hey, this test failed. Let me try to understand why it failed. So if you can give a better assertion message that gives the tester a clue about why this may have failed, it's going to make everybody's lives easier. So I'll say quantity should have reverted to 1. And that way, if it's not 1, they'll get a message. So we'll just generate that code. If I wanted to, I could keep recording additional assertions, but this is a very simple test, so we'll capture that. That added a new method in here, and it basically is just validating that those values are what they say they should be. So now I'll just right-click and say run test, and this is going to run this test 3 times because we have 3 different rows of data within our test parameters. If we updated that test parameter, added a 4th row, of course it would run a 4th time. So you'll notice that I recorded my test using Internet Explorer, and it's playing back by default in Internet Explorer. But we added the ability in Visual Studio 2012, I think it was update 1, it may have been update 2, I can't remember. Just get update 3, actually, that's the newest one, we just shipped it today. But when you have those updates, you'll be able to actually take your tests, you can record them in Internet Explorer, and then you can play them back in any browser that's supported by Selenium. So Selenium is a great open source testing framework. And what we do is we actually layer on top of Selenium so that you can change the default browser that you're using, or you can change it with each successive test run to say, play this test back in Firefox, play it back in Chrome. And so because we actually run these tests and do all of the inspections at the DOM layer, there's a good chance that you might find something works well in IE but not in Chrome, or vice versa. So it's a nice way for you to be able to run those tests. And of course, you can use multiple versions of IE as well. But of course, if you do that, you'll need to set up different machines because you'll need to have you can only have one version of IE per machine. So that's a very basic coded UI test. Like I say, I've done other sessions in the past on coded UI tests. So if you want to go deeper into those tests, you can certainly look for those sessions on Channel 9. The next thing I wanted to talk about is how you can set up build, deploy, test workflows automatically with Team Foundation Server. And basically, the idea with the build, deploy, test workflow is that you can kick off a build. You can then automatically take that build and push it out to an environment or multiple environments. So you might have multiple environments to simulate different configurations of software that your customer might be running. And then you can deploy your code out to that environment, which might mean running a web deployment script against the web server and a database deployment script against the database. And then you can run all of your automated tests against that environment. You can use your manual tests for that environment as well. And then if you find any bugs, you could, if you're using a virtual environment, you could snapshot that entire environment. And that way, when you create a bug, you can provide a pointer directly to that snapshot so that when the developer opens it up, they don't have to say, well, it works on my machine, because you can actually show them an environment where it's broken and it's reproducing the bug. This is just a basic architecture diagram showing you how you would set this up. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but basically the test controller is responsible for orchestrating the tests across the entire workflow. We use Team Build, which is our automated build server within Team Foundation Server, to automate everything else, such as the deployment into each one of these environments. And we have multiple environment types I'll talk about in a minute. If you use SCVMM, SCVMM is from the System Center family and allows you to manage a set of virtual machines across physical hardware. And so SCVMM gives you a great experience when you use it with lab management, because you can automatically provision VMs. You can say, give me a web server and a database server. It should have this much RAM. And then a few minutes later, you've got those machines running. And then you can clean up the environment once you're done and go back to kind of a clean snapshot state. SCVMM is not for everyone, however. So we introduced a new type of environment in 2012 for people that want to get started with lab management, but you may not have all of the expertise or the hardware available to set up your own SCVMM environment. And so this new environment type is called a standard environment. And quite simply, any Windows machine that you have administrative credentials for can become a machine that participates as a standard environment for you. So a very common scenario I see a lot of people doing is they say, you know, I'm a SharePoint developer. I develop on Windows 8, and occasionally I need to deploy my code into a SharePoint machine and make sure that everything works correctly. Well, how do you do that on Windows 8? It can be kind of tricky to do that. But maybe you have a spare dev machine under your box, or maybe you have an MSDN subscription, and so you can spin up an IaaS machine in the cloud. And you want that machine to be just a machine you can push to multiple times per day, run your tests, and make sure everything looks good. That's a great example of where you can use a standard environment to get started with lab management. You'll still have to manage all the snapshots yourself. If you need to do network fencing, that's a capability that's only in SCVMM environments. But for most people I talk to, standard environments provide a lot of value, and you can get started in just a few minutes with a standard environment. I'm going to show you just a very quick demonstration of what a standard environment looks like. For this demonstration, I'm actually using the same set of virtual machines. There's a hands-on lab I've written, so you can go back and set up this environment for yourself if you want to. But here you can see that I have two VMs running. This is the one I've been using all day, and then this one is a guest VM. It happens to be another virtual machine running on Hyper-V, but this could just as easily be a machine running an IaaS. It could be a physical machine. It could be a machine on someone else's box using VirtualBox. For this point, it really doesn't matter as long as you have network access and admin credentials to it. And in order for me to set up that environment, what I needed to do, I'll just switch to my other project here. When I set up that environment, I came into the lab center. So we've been in the test center all morning, but now I'm switching to the lab center. And I set up this environment by just clicking on new. I'm not going to set up a new one from scratch, but I'll show you the things I needed to specify. All I needed to do is say the name of the machine, the administrative credentials that are required to connect to that machine, and then finally, if I'm running coded UI tests in that environment, I need to specify the credentials for the account that runs those coded UI tests, because it actually needs to be logged in as an interactive process, because it needs to assume that it's a user sitting at a mouse and keyboard. If you're not running coded UI tests, you don't need to do that. You can stay at the lock screen and run unit tests all day long as a service. After I did that, I came back into the testing center, and I created just a very basic test case. And this test case started out as a manual test, but then what I did is I created a coded UI test, and I linked that coded UI test to this manual test. And so what that does is it says, this gives me an ability to run the same test case using a coded UI test. You can still run it as a manual test if you want to. Oftentimes, you'll run it as a coded UI test, and then if something fails, you might go back and run it as a manual test just to make sure that it really is a failure in the application and not in the test. But you can then take all of the test cases in your plan, and you can run them as part of your build, deploy, test workflow. Now, if I come back into Visual Studio and I look at my builds, this is really where the magic happens. Actually, let me switch projects again. This is what defines what happens when I run a build, deploy, test workflow. So if I take a look at this build definition, for those of you that have used team build in the past, this should look very familiar. The main difference when you're setting up a team build for build, deploy, test is that you change the build process template. Instead of the standard template, you use the lab default template. And then this gives you a wizard down here that allows you to define what environment are you using, and what do you want to build, what do you want to deploy, and what do you want to test. And so here I'm answering the question. This is the environment that I showed you earlier from the lab screen. This is what I want to build, which points at another build definition within Team Foundation Server. However, you could point, if you wanted to, over to an existing build or a drop location. But the way this is configured right now, we'll kick off a compilation build before we run the deployment steps. And then this specifies the list of steps we're going to run to actually deploy your application. There's no magic here, so if you run a batch file to deploy your application, you should probably think about just reusing that batch file here. What is different is that you can actually run this different commands on different machines. So if I had a web server and a SQL server, I might want to run a web deploy on the web server and run a SQL script on the other server. The nice thing about this is that anything you do here is going to automatically be reported back into your build report. So if there was a problem deploying the build, you would see that problem in your lab management build workflow so you could troubleshoot it later on. And then finally, what do you want to test? And so this just points over at the test plan I just showed you, which only has a single test case for now. And then it says run that using any tests that need to run in this particular environment configuration. So if my virtual machine is happy and warmed up, this should work. I should be able to just queue a new build. One of the things you can do with team build is you can override the parameters that you're using when you kick off any build. And so I'll just do this to save us a little bit of time, because what I'll do is instead of kicking off a new build definition or a new compilation, I'll just run the last successful build that I ran this morning. And that'll just save us a little bit of time. But now when I queue this build, it's going to kick off this build script. I can troubleshoot everything and see exactly what's happening. But what's probably most interesting for us to do is to come back and look at the remote machine, because in a few minutes it's going to try to run through my test case if my machine is still awake. Sometimes it goes to sleep during my demo, so fingers crossed. So while we're waiting for that to run, does anybody have any questions about lab management? Yeah. So I think your question is when you when you run a lab management workflow, can you queue that off of whether or not a build was successful? Is that the idea?
Yeah, well, what the criteria, what build to select. You know, here you can rebuild something or create or select the latest successful build.
Right.
It would be interesting to also be able to select the latest successful build with certain status.
Sure. Yeah, so his question is whether or not you can, as part of this workflow, say instead of running the last success or the last build, just run the last successful build. Usually the way that you would do that is you would actually kick off a new build as part of the lab management build deploy test process, and if that build failed, you would just stop the build deploy test workflow at that point. Now you could also do what you're describing, which is to say that you're only going to build using the last successful build that's in the queue. That would require a little bit more customization of the build workflow, but it uses Windows workflow behind the scenes, and that's easy enough for you to go back in and just add that as a criteria. So I hope that answers your question. Back here.
If you run the UI test, then the coordinates of the buttons and so on are recorded. What happens if you change the resolution or something like that?
Great question. So he's pointing out the fact that when you record a coded UI test, we actually capture the coordinates of where you clicked into a text box or clicked into a button control, for example. And he's rightfully pointing out that if we use those coordinates to play back the test, then you change the resolution of the application, then the test is going to fail. And he's right about that, but we actually don't use those coordinates to drive the test unless we absolutely have to. That's only the fallback. So this is something that I get into more detail in my longer coded UI testing talk. But just to give you the quick summary of that, when we capture the actions that you're recording for a coded UI test, we capture everything that Windows knows about the controls that you're working with. So if you're using an accessible control, and what I mean by that is, you know, something that implements all the accessibility hooks in Windows, or something like in the browser document object model when you're recording a web browser test, we actually know a lot about those controls. We know the position in the control hierarchy. We know the name of those controls. We know, you know, the type of control that it is. And there's a long list of things that we'll go through to try to find that control before we use the XY coordinate. And so as long as you're using those types of controls, everything should work just fine. Now, if you click into a Flash application, Flash happens to be one of those applications that we don't support. We don't know the difference between different controls within Flash. However, if you record your tests in such a way so that you always guarantee that that Flash console is the same size, the controls are relative, you know, the same position, then XY coordinates should work for you. There's a long list of rules that apply to how this works, so you can customize a lot of those rules if you want to, but most of the time it just works. There is another reason that we do capture the XY coordinates, and I'll show you an example of what that can be useful for. If you guys remember the start button, I know this has been gone for a while. This button actually uses what's called a split button. And so if you take a look at this, when I mouse over, it actually gives me different behaviors, even though it's the same control. So that's a good example of where XY is actually very helpful to play back in that specific location. And if you did have resolution changes, there's a possibility that that could introduce some problems if the size of the control changed. But I would say 99% of the controls that we work with, that doesn't matter. So yeah, thank you for asking that question. Who else? Yeah.
I've got an environment currently that I work on. It consists of two virtual machines and a database server somewhere.
Okay.
What I do now is that I have test agents deployed in both machines, but I want to have multiple environments, as that is what I have now. So I have
sure.
Dev 1, Dev 2, Test 1, Test 2. Is it recommended to do that? To deploy to the same machine but a different environment, just using different settings? Or will that break something?
This might be one of those that we want to save offline, because I don't quite follow the entire example, but maybe we can draw it out afterwards. I'll definitely stick around for as much time as it takes. Yeah. Anybody else? Yeah.
Can I use VMware E6 or just Hyper-V?
Can you use VMware? You can use any virtualization stack or physical environment for a standard environment like what I'm showing you. If you want to use an SCVMM environment, then you have to use SCVMM with Hyper-V. I think that's everything. If I don't see you, please just throw something at me. It's hard to see with the lights on. So I just want to wrap up by talking a little bit about reporting. I don't know if anyone recognizes this gentleman. It's Lord Kelvin. He invented the Kelvin scale. And he's oftentimes attributed with this quote, which is that you can't really measure something. You can't manage something unless you can measure it. I like to call him the grandfather of Team Foundation Server, because I think if he was around, he would really appreciate what we're trying to do with software development. And that is that oftentimes there's a lot of stuff that happens across your software development team and project and different interactions that you have with stakeholders and other people, like the operations team, that unless you can really get all of that data into one place and start to analyze it, it can become very difficult as a software professional to understand what you need to do to make higher quality, better software. And so I just want to remind you of some of the reports that are available within Team Foundation Server to help you answer these questions. These reports have been around in TFS for quite a while, so I'm not showing anything brand new here. But a lot of people, I find, still don't use the reports as much as they could be. This is what I like to call the Steven Sinofsky report. I'm sure you probably know Steven. He used to ship Windows and Office for Microsoft, really great engineering lead. And what a lot of people don't know is that his team, when he was building Office and Windows 7, they actually started to adopt Team Foundation Server so that they could get this type of data. And so as an example, he can look from left to right on a report like this, and he can start to understand for a particular feature or user story or requirement that he might care about, how much of the code has been written. But then he can also look further over to the right and start to answer the question of, you know, how many test cases do we have? So if I look at the second one here, you know, I'm about 80% done from a coding perspective, but I actually don't have any test cases written. And so that's a problem. I should probably drill in to try to understand how we're going to ensure that this capability is actually implemented correctly. A couple in here, you know, this is just showing your bugs. Hopefully the bugs are going down over time. This is code coverage and code churn. So typically, these code coverage should be going up and code churn should be going down as you get towards the end of an iteration. If it's not, then that could signal that a lot of people are checking in a bunch of code at the end of the iteration. And that could be a warning sign that you have a bunch of new code that's not really getting the proper testing it deserves. This is one of my favorite perspectives because it shows the importance of having multiple dimensions of data to rely on. If you look at the top graph, this is the amount of hours remaining that the development team is working on to actually burn down work within the project. And if this was the only chart you looked at, you might look at this and say, you know, our project looks pretty good. We're kind of following the straight line, and by Friday, we'll have a great build to ship to the customer. But if you look at the other perspective, if you look at the user story perspective, it tells a kind of a different story. Because the blue user stories indicate work that the team is still working on. The yellow indicates user stories that the team says are ready for the test team to sign off on. And then the green, which of course you don't see any green, means user stories that are actually done. So here I am just 2 days before the end of the iteration, and most of our user stories are not even ready for the test team to work on. And this is a good opportunity for me to say, okay, we need to focus on maybe getting one or two more user stories done and ready for testing, and maybe one of these other user stories we should postpone to the next iteration and make sure the customer knows it's just not ready yet. And these are some of the ways that we surface this information and help you make these decisions in real time, as opposed to trying to discover these things at the end of your iteration. So I won't go through all the reports. They're in my slide deck if you want to take a look at them. The one last thing I did want to leave you with was just how you can get started with Team Foundation Service. You see this URL in the lower right-hand corner where you can go sign up for an account. What we have announced is that Team Foundation Service will be free for teams of up to 5 people, which is great. If you have bigger teams and those team members have MSDN subscribers, then that's included as an MSDN benefit for those additional people. And then sometime in the future when we announce commercial pricing, you'll be able to decide whether or not you want to use the Team Foundation Service for those scenarios as well. But for the time being, it's still free for everyone. So we would love to get your feedback. We'd love to see you start using some of these capabilities. And everything that I showed you works with Team Foundation Service or on-premises Team Foundation Server. So I think I'm just about out of time, so I will wrap up and thank you for coming, but I'm going to stick around right after my session and continue to answer questions as long as they'll let me. So thank you very much for coming.